Today on The Grave Talks, we continue our conversation about ghostly tales of the Berkshires with author Robert Oakes. Is it because of living in the Berkshires for so long that you decided to write the book, Ghosts of the Berkshires?
Yeah.
And just hearing stories?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Berkshires. You know, it really is a very special place. You know, I wanted the opportunity to write a book for sure. At that point, I hadn't yet written a book. So it was exciting when I was approached about doing this book. What also excited me was that I knew that this would give me the chance to write about this place and explore these places that people say are haunted, get to know them better and like really, you know, and talk to people about their experiences and document it and just kind of, you know, tell the Berkshire story. And that was exciting to me, like to be able to do that, because I had at that point lived in the Berkshires for 15 years or so. And so it really had become like my adopted home. And now I had this chance to write about it in this really special way. So I was pretty excited.
Can I ask you about a couple of the stories in the book? The one I was very interested in because it's just so tragic is the, and correct me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, Hoosac Tunnel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hoosac Tunnels.
Hoosac. Yeah, okay. Hoosac.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those where these men, so many men lost their lives building this tunnel so the train could go through, correct?
Yeah. They had to carve their way through 5 miles through, you know, through a mountain to create a tunnel for a railroad track to pass through.
And, you know, as in any kind of job like that would be highly dangerous, especially when was it built? This was
the early 19th century.
Okay. So it was, you know, it wasn't like they have the equipment we have today. Even today, that would be a dangerous job. But when you think back then, and so there was some really tragic things that happened, and there's paranormal activity associated with it, would you say to this day, or just is it more of an urban legend?
Well, that's interesting, right? Because some of the things that people say about the Hoosac Tunnel, there really is no, it's not clear whether they ever really happened. Like the thing I wrote about the explosion that involved Ringo Kelly and Ned Brinkman and Billy Nash, you know, that is a story that people tell where the one man set off a charge and it blew up too soon and these other men died. And then the story is that they found the other man's body a year later after this incident and believed that their ghosts had killed him. The ghosts of the two men that he had killed. Now, did that ever really happen? Unclear. But that is a story that people tell about the Hoosac Tunnel. Even at the time, you know, when the men were digging the tunnel, the story is that they would report hearing sounds in the tunnel, hearing the sound of voices, believing that maybe there were spirits in the tunnel, possibly of the men that they knew who had worked with them there and had died. And so it really started to freak a lot of these guys out, I think. But those are all very old stories. But they do continue, people do continue to tell stories about the Hoosac Tunnel. And in fact, I was just doing a reading on Friday night in North Adams, which is one of the towns that the tunnel empties out into. And people up there, I mean, some of them, you know, have family members like generations back who worked on the tunnel. It's very personal. It's very near to them, to that community. And people say that a lot of the stone that had been excavated from the tunnel was used to build the foundations of many of the buildings in that city of North Adams. And so it is very much close to people's lives up there in North Adams. And after this reading that I did on Friday night, a woman approached me after at the end and told me that her son-in-law was running a construction operation in the tunnel recently, like within the last 20 years, and had this experience of being told by one of the men on his crew that they had left somebody, that they believed they had left somebody in the tunnel because they saw somebody on the tracks. But there was no one on the tracks. They hadn't left anyone behind. They just, somebody reported seeing a figure on the tracks in the middle of the tunnel. And that's a pretty recent experience, you know.
And it was so real. It's like we left somebody in there. We got to get them out. Can't leave anybody there.
Yes. And that's very much, I think, a part of the experience of the tunnel is that feeling of being, you know, trapped in underground or under the mountain, you know, deep in a dark place where you shouldn't be. And you feel it even when you go near it. So you can, like, I do not recommend that people go into the tunnel. It is an active railway line. Although I've heard from people who say that they do, but you can get near to it and you can sort of look at it from a distance and you can feel it. You can feel the cold of the place. And you can, if you know, you could just look at the entrance of it and it just, it's so dark. It's so, like, it just feels like total absence of light. Like, it's just like this void that you're looking at.
It's a long tunnel, isn't it?
It's 5 miles.
5 miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't even wrap my brain around how they even did that.
And it amazes me exactly that they were able to do that at that time. Like, because they actually built three, like they built from three directions. They started in Florida on one side, the town of Florida. They started in the town of city of North Adams on the other side. And they also built a central shaft from the top. And somehow they managed to like connect. And they weren't using, you know, GPS or whatever we use today to do that kind of work. It's amazing to me. It really is.
I could see.
I don't know.
If I would have been involved with it, you know, we would have been like 50 feet off.
Yeah, and I think they said something like it was
That's
like
incredible.
They connected within inches.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
I just found that so interesting because there was, you know, hundreds of men who worked on the tunnel, but I think it said hundreds of men actually died working on the tunnel.
Yeah,
I don't remember the numbers.
I mean, what I had learned was it was like 200 out of the 800 died.
Isn't that something?
I had been told. Yeah.
The other story that I found interesting because it was almost, did this woman put a curse on these people? But it was the Searles Castle. Am I saying that correctly?
Oh, Searles. Yeah, Searles Castle.
Searles Castle. So Mary Hopkins designed this huge castle and it looks like a castle. It really does. Mm-hmm. So she designs this with this guy, Edward Searles, and she's 68, he's 46. They ended up married. So it was like, did he really want to marry the 68-year-old or did he really want her money?
But that's what people would say. Yeah.
What I found interesting is that in the book, it said she died suspiciously 4 years after getting married. But then he was supposedly having an affair with a maid and maybe they had killed her. But then the two of them, she dies suspiciously falling down the stairs, and he died when a chandelier fell on him.
I'm like, well, that's the story, right? Like,
do you think that actually happened like that?
No.
Okay.
I don't.
That is absurd because I'm like, did that really happen? Or was that Mary saying
that? See, that's where like it. To me, the stories are so interesting because a story like that says a lot more about what people imagine, you know, when they look at a place like that and they think, oh, yeah, I know what went on in there, you know, and they tell this story. It seems pretty unlikely that that happened for real. But that doesn't mean that nothing happened. Right. Like, that's what always gets
me. It's based somewhere.
Yeah. And that, you know, I'll often say this about Mount Greylock, the Mount Greylock story. Mount Greylock is in the Berkshires. It's the tallest peak in Massachusetts. And there's a story associated with it about a ghost called the Old Coot. People say he was a Civil War soldier who returned from war to find that his wife had sort of remarried and thought he was dead. And, you know, so he went on to live alone on the mountain. And then when he died, people say his ghost haunts the mountain. And they're very specific about where they believe he haunts the mountain at this intersection of these two trails called the Bellows Pipe and the Thunderbolt. Now, was there ever really an Old Coot, right? And did this story have any truth to it? There are people who say no, absolutely not. And they point to the original sort of the earliest known documentation of this story, which was a newspaper article from the 30s that is promoting a downhill ski race on one of those trails. And in the article, it says, you know, look for the old Coots ghost who will be at this particular spot at this particular time, and you'll see him there, you know. And right, like any of us who have had any dealings with ghosts know that they tend not to show up on on their mark as you tell them.
Yes, any paranormal investigator will tell you that.
Yeah. So that has led people to conclude that the whole thing was just this publicity stunt that somebody came up with, like, oh, I don't know, let's tell this story about this ghost that haunts the mountain, and people will come just to look for the ghost, and you know, they'll come to our race. And that led to a series of, you know, other reports, like then somebody said they photographed the old coot, and there was a, not long after that, there's a picture that appears in the paper that looks, you know, like this figure like walking toward the woods. And they say, that's the old coot, you know. And then even just up until just 20 years ago, I found in the Berkshire Eagle, you know, announcement, like people advertising events, like, come and look for the old coot with us. You know, we're going to go hunting for the coot. And so it's definitely a story that has stuck, regardless of whether there ever really was a coot, right? Certainly now there's a story of a coot. You know, my feeling about that is that in this case, it really doesn't matter to me whether there is a coot, because I believe that there is something. There's something about that mountain, and it inspires people. Mm-hmm. It inspires these feelings in people. And that, I think, is what maybe leads to a story like that getting told. Even if that story isn't true, it doesn't mean that there isn't something about that place that inspires these feelings in people. And actually, I recently spoke to someone who came on one of my ghost tours who lived in that area, whose family has lived near the mountain for a few generations. And my God, she was, I mean, one after another, just the different experiences she said her family members had of encountering the old coot on the mountain.
It starts somewhere. There's something that happened at one point. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like that game of, was it called telephone when your kids, I think, depending on where you live in the country, it might be called different things, where you whisper something to someone who tells someone who tells someone. And then by the time it goes all around the circle, it's a different story.
Yes.
And it's kind of like that.
That is interesting to me. Like, it's interesting to me what inspires the story and the mystery that may be at the heart of it. And it also interests me the way that people tell them and share them, and then how they get embellished and changed. And, mm-hmm. you know, that phenomenon. There was an example of one that I wrote about in the New Jersey book. In a town, it's based in a town, it was Morristown. And there was a ghost that haunted the town that was seen near the railroad tracks. I'm trying to just put the story back together in my head. That it was sort of terrorizing the town for a while at the end of the 19th century. And there were these particular incidents that happened where people said they saw it here, or they saw it there, or this person saw it. And I published the book. I had found all of these, you know, reports about it in the newspapers in the 19th century. And somebody contacted me and said, you know, you've got that story wrong. It didn't happen in Morristown. It happened in Moorestown. And it's a little bit different. And I was like, oh my God, did I get it wrong? You know, I was like really concerned about this because, you know, I try to get it right, you know? And I went back and looked at my research and said, well, no, I mean, here it is. It's Morristown. It's this ghost that haunted the town and so forth. But then he had shared with me what he had found. And it was so much of the same, but it was Morristown, which is a very similar sounding name.
Mm-hmm.
As Morristown, and you think at some point somebody got the name wrong, you know, and this other story like split from the, you know, the two stories kind of diverged and became their own thing, and then continued to be told. And so now there's two of them. One in Morristown and one in Morristown.
And you know, I think that's so interesting. I was having a conversation about that just this week about bridges, because there's so many communities that have that story of the bridge. And it might be you, or there might even be a stretch of road. Like you can park your car on it and your car will move. Or you hear the baby crying in the distance, or the woman who jumped from the bridge. And there's probably, I don't know, I would say it's 3 or 4 miles from my house, a bridge where I live that has all those same stories about it. And I find that so interesting that those same things are happening on bridges all over the country. Is it that kind of thing? Did it get started one place and then somebody had a weird experience and they're like, oh, it happened at Amarosa's bridge?
And I think that, like, I think sometimes that phenomenon that does happen, right? I think sometimes it's used as a way to dismiss the whole thing and say, well, it's just people telling stories because, you know, how could the same thing happen in one place that also happened someplace else? And it like makes the whole thing seem like less credible. But I actually think it's something different from that. I think that what it is that people feel things about certain places and they don't know how to talk about it. It's just like, there's something about this place. And then maybe they heard a story about another place that's similar, or, you know, and so then they start telling that same kind of story about this place. I feel like that's sometimes how these stories get associated with different places, and that the story may not be true, like I said, but something is true about that place. Like, it does feel like something to people, and they're just trying to grasp it. Like, how do I talk about this? You know,
writing books that have haunted locations, ghost stories in them, you would encounter that quite a bit, I would think, kind of an urban legend slash ghost story.
Yeah, like I was, again, in New Jersey, I wrote about the Hookerman lights in Flanders. There's this story about this ball of light that people would see moving down the railroad tracks in this town, Flanders. And again, people began to tell a story about it. It was a railroad worker in the 19th century who lost his hand in a railway accident, and the hand had his wedding ring on it. And when he died, he went looking for this hand because he wanted to get his wedding ring back. And, you know, for all eternity, he's walking up and down these tracks, holding up a lantern by the hook on his, that it replaced the hand that he lost, looking for this hand with the wedding ring on it. And that's one of the stories people would tell to explain this light. Now, from what I understand, probably the Hookerman, as they call him, never existed, right? But the light apparently did. People would see this light moving down the railroad tracks. And there was a group in the 70s that documented it. And they would sort of try to explain, and different people had theories about it that had to do with, like, you know, sort of a phenomenon, bioluminescence phenomenon, or something having to do with a fault line that runs through that part of New Jersey that would produce this electric. I'm not enough of a scientist to know all of the science behind it, but that there was a scientific explanation for it. And that once they remove the railroad tracks, people stopped seeing the light. And so they believed that it had something to do with the metal conducting this electricity down the line.
Oh, that's interesting. That they would have even figured it out.
Yeah, right, exactly.
People are way smarter than me.
Yeah, and that others had theories about, like, gas, because there's these sort of swampy areas nearby. So they would talk about, like, gas, like the same thing as, like, the will-o'-the-wisp phenomenons that would, like, produce these, like, ball lights in swampy areas that was, like, phosphorescence or something like that, bioluminescence. Looking into the story, I found this kind of phenomenon all over the place, all over the U.S. and other places too, where people would see these same kind of lights. And, you know, the Marfa lights, I believe it is, in Texas. Mm-hmm. There was a place near Missouri. I forget the name of it now, but there's like tri-corner. There's like three states that come together and they see similar lights. But there was one that was almost exactly the same in North Carolina, also involved a railway track, also involved a railway worker that supposedly was injured in an accident. And, you know, so same phenomenon, similar story in some of the cases, different story in other cases. And that's just an interesting thing to notice.
Now, you've got a website, and it's robertoakes.net, and it's O-A-K-E-S. And I'll put a link in the show description. But there's information on all three books that we've talked about today, but also the events. Like, if you do get to the Berkshires and you could go on one of the ghost tours of the Vent Fort, you've got all that information on there. And then one other thing that you do that I thought was really good is if you go to the videos tab, Robert tells some of these stories, and you have a really great storytelling voice.
Oh, thank you.
And so it was really interesting to watch those videos, so I would recommend those to people. But yeah, thank you. There's lots of information about Robert on the website. But yeah, this was really, really interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. It was really great to talk to you.
And that wraps up our conversation with Robert Oakes about his book, Ghostly Tales of the Berkshires. For more information, visit his website at robertoakes.net. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, you can become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts where you can try it for 3 days free, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.